Brother Carl has selected for his title, Seeing the Invisible. Seeing the Invisible. That sounds exciting. Brother Carl.
You know, when I was back in grade school, there was one course that I liked so much better than all other courses. It was called recess. Recess was the time you got a little exercise. I was thinking about that today. I was thinking, you're sitting around here not getting enough exercise. Maybe we need an exercise time. We're going to do a little exercising now. I was also watching you during your recess for your intermission, and the jaws are getting good exercise. They're doing very well. But it's the right hand that I'm worried about. You know, I see it exercised a lot extended this way and shaking up and down somehow. And I see a lot of it exercised in circling motions, you know. But I haven't seen a lot of exercise in upward motion. So we're going to do some upward motion exercises. We're going to do a little voting. That's what it amounts to. I want to give you 10 experiences from the life of Moses. I'm just going to mention the experience. And I want you, when I give the experience, if you think that that particular experience was an outstanding, and only it was outstanding, if that was an outstanding exercise of faith, then exercise. Raise your hand. And each of these 10, I want to find out something before I get myself into a trap here in my talk. I've got to get an audience participation here a little bit. When Moses rejected Pharaoh's house to become a Hebrew, do you think that was an outstanding act of faith? How many? Okay. When Moses, after intervening with that quarrel with the two brothers, had to flee to the wilderness, had to get out of the land, how many think that was an outstanding act of faith? Okay. When Moses in the wilderness was at the burning bush, and the Lord said, now you got to go back and face those people again. And he went back. How many think that was an outstanding act of faith? Okay. When Moses had the courage to stand before Pharaoh and said, you let our people go or you're going to get plagued. How many think that was an outstanding act of faith? Okay. When Moses celebrated the Passover the first time, how many think that was an outstanding act of faith? Okay. When Moses held up his rod and said, by holding this up, that Red Sea's going to part and you're going to walk through, how many thought that was an outstanding act of faith? That was pretty unanimous on that one. When Moses led Israel for 40 years through the wilderness, not knowing where the next day's food is going to come from. Oh, I did too. He knew it was going to rain manna in the morning. But how many thought that was an outstanding act of faith? Okay. What kind of boat was that, Jim? You put it all in half and half boat. Okay. When Moses went up Mount Sinai to receive the Ten Commandments, how many think that was an outstanding act of faith? Okay. When Moses pleaded with God that God not destroy Israel, even though God said he was ready to destroy them, he said, destroy me instead of destroying them. How many think that was an act of faith? And the last one, not the second time, now the first time when Moses smote a rock and said, when I hit that rock, water's going to come out. How many think that was an act of faith? Okay, I noticed that from the votes, all but two of these received an outstanding majority. One of these only received 7 votes. And one received a smattering, maybe 25 or 30. I didn't really count. Only about 25 or 30 raised their hand for celebrating the first Passover. And only 7 raised their hand when he fled into the wilderness. You know, it's interesting that the Apostle Paul, in Hebrews the 11th chapter, selects out of Moses' life 4 acts of faith. 2 of those are those he didn't vote for. he selected the fleeing into the wilderness as one. And he selected the first Passover as one. He agreed with you on leaving Pharaoh's house, and he agreed on the Red Sea. As long as he agreed. But there are two, it was different. Now I'm going to talk about one of them. I'm going to talk about the fleeing into the wilderness. Because if anything that I wouldn't have voted for, my hands would have been like this. You know, that does not show faith. That just shows the power of fear. In fact, Exodus, the second chapter, let's read it. Verse 14 and 15. This is what Moses says about it, or has said about it, has had written about it. And he, the Hebrew, said, "Who made us thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou killest the Egyptian?" And Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses, but Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh, and he dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now that certainly supports this. You know, we read this very simply. Moses got in trouble, Moses got afraid, and Moses fled. It's very simple. Three simple steps. Paul reads this with a different step. Paul says, Moses got in trouble. Moses had faith, and Moses fled. Let's look at it. Hebrews 11, 27. That's our text. Hebrews 11, 27. By faith, Moses forsook Egypt, not fearing. That's what it says. Not fearing the wrath of the king. For he endured as seeing him who was invisible. Paul reads the Bible differently than you and I do. He sees something that we didn't see. He sees that act as faith. I've been taking a lot of polls the last three or four conventions on this question. I've been doing it a little different than here. I've been asking just a lot of individual brethren, give me the four most outstanding acts in Moses' life. That is an interesting variety. But only one person said, well, you got to start with this fleeing Egypt. And I turned to the person and said, you're right, but how? Why? How did you know that? Well, this happened to be an individual who, when they accepted the Lord's word for their life, went through tremendous family persecution and finally had to leave home. And the person said, because I went through it. He said, I didn't leave home because I was afraid of my parents. I went because I saw the Lord's hand in that, telling me it's time to get out. But it wasn't fear. And this is exactly what Paul was saying. That Moses did not fear Pharaoh. Never did Exodus say he feared Pharaoh. Said he feared. Didn't say he feared Pharaoh. And Paul rightly reads that. And he said that what happened, Moses saw that Pharaoh was angry, and Moses said, oh, God is saying it's not time for me yet to move. And by faith, he waited. He went to the next step. And that's what Paul is saying when he says he didn't fear, but he saw the invisible. He saw something behind that experience that you and I didn't see. Well, seven of you did see. But other than the seven astute ones here, most of us missed that, and I certainly missed it. That this was seeing God's hand in Pharaoh's problem. And not fear, but the faith to wait. Wait. Wait until he finally knew he was of no use. So when God talked to him and said, now I can use you, he said, oh no, there's nothing left to use. Now I'm 80 years old and there's just nothing left. He said, that's what I was waiting for. I was waiting for you to get that point, and now you've got there. Now take your next step of faith and go back. And do what you want to do 40 years ago. This was the perception. It is a submission to the recognition that the reality of adverse circumstances can be God's hand to cause us to delay, to wait, to hold until he is ready for us to move. The supreme example of submissive waiting is the example of Jesus before Annas, Caiaphas, and later before Pontius. Jesus there totally submits to incorrect, unrighteous, unjust judgments. And he doesn't even defend himself. Rather, in fulfillment of Isaiah 53, like the lamb before his shearers was dumb. With his mental acuity, with his perception of the depths of God's law, what a defense he could have made. That whole trial could have been turned around. Even if Annas and Caiaphas still wanted to kill him, he could have swayed the audience, so they couldn't have done it. He could have changed the atmosphere. But he didn't. He submitted to injustice. Why? Prophetically, we're told in 39 Psalm, the 9th verse. This is the only scripture that tells us why he didn't say anything. Isaiah said he wouldn't, but Psalm says why he wouldn't. Psalm 39:9. I was dumb, I opened not my mouth, because thou didst it. He was not submitting to the unjust right rule of Caiaphas, Annas, or Pilate. He was submitting to the invisible behind it. He saw God's hand and he said, these aren't what I'm submitting to. I am submitting to this because God is behind this, and that's what I came to earth with, to die. He saw the invisible, and that's where the submission came. In 1 Peter, the second chapter, from verse 13 through 1 Peter, the third chapter, verse 7, you have a long dissertation on the doctrine of submission. We're not going to get into great detail here. That's a separate talk in itself. But in this, there's a point you'd like to notice in our submission, in seeing the invisible. This doctrine of submission, as outlined by Peter, is broken into four sections. Chapter 2, verses 13 to 17 deal with submission to ordinances of men. Verses 18 to the end of the chapter deal with submission of slaves to masters, or if you want to go 20th century, employees to employers. Third chapter, the first six verses, are the submission of wives to husbands. The seventh is the submission of husbands to wives. So these should round the whole picture out. These are the four submissions he's talking. Now we're going to just deal with one of these, submission of masters to servants, because it deals directly with our issue here. In the 18th verse, Peter says, servants, be subject to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the froward. Froward is a word we don't use very much. I'm going to use not a synonym, but a word that encapsulates what it means. Not only to the good, but to the obnoxious. To the one you can't stand. Still, submit. That's what he's saying. Submit in either case. But when you submit to the forward, to the obnoxious, many times you're submitting to injustice. Because many of the demands that are made are unjust and they're not within your contract. And he's saying, submit. But then he tells you why. For this is thankworthy. If a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully, says that suffering in unjust circumstances as a result of submission is praiseworthy. And so as a result, he said, he counsels them to submit because in that they are seeing not the injustice of the employer or the master, but they're seeing the instructing hand of God in the teaching of the power of submissiveness. And because they're seeing that, they're not submitting to the master, they're submitting to God in the experience he permits them to come into. Now in 1 Corinthians he does give them out. He says, but if you have the chance to be free, take it. So he doesn't fully put it down, but he does have this thought of submission in seeing God's just hand in our experience. In Lamentations, the third chapter, there's a lesson that bears on this very clearly. You know, we love that song, Great is Thy Faithfulness. That's from Lamentations 3. We want to go after that in the context. We want to read verses 27 to 30. It is good for a man that he bear the yoke in his youth. He sits alone He keeps silence because he has borne it upon him. He puts his mouth in the dust, if so be there may be hope. He gives his cheek to him that smiteth. He's still full of reproach. Stop right there. Lift up your eyes. Don't read any further. What are you saying? It doesn't hurt you to suffer a little bit wrongfully. It doesn't hurt to eat a little dust. It doesn't really hurt to get down on your knees at times. Even unjustly. And they were. This was under Babylonian rule that he was saying to submit to. But now he tells you why. Now put your head down and read the rest of the verse. Because the Lord will not cast off forever. Although he caused grief, yet he will have compassion according to the multitude of his mercy. He doesn't afflict willingly, nor grieve the children of men to crush under his feet all the prisoners of the earth, to turn aside the right of a man before the face of the Most High, to subvert in a man in his cause, the Lord approveth not. That's the other side of the coin. He says, submit, because you see the invisible molding hand of God. Knowing that submitting to his hand, the coin will turn, and it will not be forever. And the other side will come when he has seen you've had enough of the fire. Then he'll put you in the cooling thing to gel the mold that was there. This is the invisible that you see. One of the greatest examples of the counseling in this concept of masters and servants is that tiny little epistle of Philemon or Philemon, where there is a servant that Paul suggests goes back to his master. And in the little epistle of Philemon, we'd like to notice just one short lesson, verses 15 and 16. And notice how in this, he is telling Onesimus, the master, to be gentle in receiving the servant back because the invisible hand of God is there. He said, perhaps he here is Onesimus, the servant, perhaps he departed for a season that you could receive him forever. Not now as a servant, but above a servant, a brother beloved, especially to me, and how much more to thee, both in the flesh and in the Lord. He was saying, now, submit, because the invisible hand of God caused him to run away. He was a runaway slave. It caused him to run away so that after a season of running, he'd come back and he'd be yours forever. You know, one of the best sayings that a parent can have on his wall, and I really love this when my children got to be 17, 18, 19, getting out of high school, that if you love something very, very much, let it go. If it comes back to you, treasure it. If it doesn't, it wasn't meant for you. To have that willingness to let go, to let go free, to give the independence that you have tried to bring into the world, the ego that takes the young up and then drops out from under it and forces it to fly on its own wings. One of the places where you really see the invisible, in Deuteronomy, the 31st chapter, the 18th verse, it talks about God's invisibility. God says of Israel, I will surely hide my face in that day for all the evils which they have wrought and all that they have turned unto the other. In the Talmud, one rabbi asks, where do we see the fulfillment of Deuteronomy 31:18? And the other rabbi answers, in the book of Esther. We're going to turn to the book of Esther. And we want to note the invisible hand of God in the story of Esther. If you will, turn with me, because I think it'll be helpful as we look at these verses together. We're not going to go through the story, because the story you know of Esther. We want to go through the invisibility of God's hand. Critics of the Bible say that one of the problems with Esther is that it's the only book in which the name God never appears. And it's true, you read from chapter 1 right through to the end, and you'll never read the word God in English or any other language with an accurate translation. The name God doesn't appear. But it's there. It's hidden in 3 of the ancient manuscripts. This word pops out at you. The word Jehovah. The book was written at a point in time in which it was illegal to talk about Jehovah. And so they didn't write about his name. But they knew his presence in the book. So in constructing it, there are four places where they chose four successive words and made the capital letters, big capitals. And those four successive capitals are Jehovah. Spell out his name in four places. He was invisible, but he was there. He was behind the whole story. We're going to look at those four places briefly. The first of those places is in the first chapter of Esther, verse 20. And it's at the time when he's invited Vashti to come before the people, and she wouldn't come, and we say out of modesty. But his counselors don't say it's out of modesty. They say there's a principle. And when the king's decree, which he shall make, shall be published throughout all the empire, for it is great, all the wives shall give their husbands the honor, both the great and the small. So it wasn't the point. The point was her role was to come. Her role was not to object for a reason. She had a role to play here, and it was to come. And if she doesn't play it, the whole thing is lost. And because of that, she was deposed, and it paved the way for Esther to become involved. So if she hadn't done this, if this role hadn't been there, you never would have had the story of Esther and the salvation of Israel twice through Esther's hand. Once in the book of Esther, and she comes up again in Nehemiah and saves Israel a second time. But Esther here, the first place is when the former queen won't go. And the translator saw, there is the hand of God. The invisible hand was behind her objection, her obstinacy, because it paved the way for Esther to become involved. Well, then the story goes along, a lot of interesting details. But you come to the fifth chapter. In the fifth chapter, in the fourth verse, you know, Esther had to be cajoled into this, in fact, almost forced into it by Haman to go before the king because she was afraid. And finally said, your wife's at stake. If you don't go, God will save Jews, but not by you. You better go. And she finally gets her courage. She goes before the king. The king says, what do you want? It's yours. And in Esther 5:4, Esther said, if it seemed good unto the king, let the king and Haman come. And in the Hebrew, those four words that say that are the word Jehovah. There is a second turning point in the book. When she gets the courage to approach the king and begin her request, that's God operating. She saw Jehovah's power operating behind her. It's invisible, but it was God was there. Third place, still in the fifth chapter, the 13th verse, Haman comes, he's treated to this big feast, going home from the feast, real happy. And then on the way home, he sees Mordecai still alive. And he says, all this avails me nothing as long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Those words, this avails me nothing. That same little hidden word, Jehovah. That's the third thing that sets the die for the book, the hardening of Haman's heart. If Haman had, by this banquet, been cajoled into it, the story would have had a whole different ending. But the hardening of his heart was again where God's hand was behind the book, bringing about the desired destination of the destruction of Israel's enemies and putting Israel in a secure position. The invisible was there. Then go to the 7th chapter and the 7th verse. And the king, arising from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden, and Haman stood up to make a request for his life to save the queen, for he saw there was evil determined. That's the phrase. There was evil determined against him by the king. He saw, as we would say in our language, the jig is up. When he saw that there was no other out, that was the final hand of God. That the only way was that destruction and the saving of Israel came through. Now, just before this, in the fifth verse, there is one other place where God's name is hidden. It's a different name of God, though. It's not Jehovah. In this case, it's the I Am name. That's hidden in the fifth verse when the king says, who is he? Where is he? Who presumes to do so. And that word, who is he? And where is he? Is the word for the I Am. There again, this hidden hand of God. So whoever composed this book composed it very carefully, noting that at every turn of the road, it may have seemed an interesting, just narrative going on, but really the invisible was there. God's hand was behind every step. And isn't that a beautiful lesson for our lives? Our lives go along day by day. This happens, that happens, we stumble from this experience to the next experience, and it's just an array of interesting life. It's fascinating. But only if we go back and look over it and look, where did God turn the way? Where do we see the invisible? Where do we see those things that God directed the path and built a little Ebenezer? That's the treasure, is to find that invisible. It's not easy to find. In the book of Job, the 23rd chapter, you have a plaint of Job in his difficulty to see the invisible. He really looked for it and he couldn't find it. Look at Job 23, and again I'm going to ask you, when you read verses 8 and 9 with me, that as soon as you finish lying, you lift up your heads and don't read any further. Try to put yourself in Job's feeling. Behold, I go forward, but he is not there. Backward, I can't perceive him. On the left hand where he works, I can't behold him. He hideth himself on the right hand, and I can't see him. He went everywhere. He went forward, he went back, he went to the right, he went to the left. No, right and the left. Gotta be my daughter, she has a little more hand, she can tell which is which. He went to this hand and that hand. And after going to all hands, I looked all around. I can't see him. He might have tried a fifth direction, he might have looked up. But he tried every other direction. And he said, I can't see him. He could not see the invisible. Now read the next verse. But he knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. There are times, even though I cannot see the invisible, I know the invisible is there, and he is working for me and on my behalf. How do we see the invisible? How do we detect him? Well, first, by looking up. That was the direction he forgot to look. But there's a scripture that tells us exactly how to see invisible things. And that's a contradiction in terms. It's in Romans, the first chapter. And he says not only can you see invisible things, you can see them clearly. Romans chapter 1, verse 20. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen. Now, isn't that a contradictory statement? Clearly seeing the invisible things. The invisible things from creation are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and, you got that funny little word Godhead in there, so they are without excuse. Now, the Greek word translated Godhead here is the only place it's used. The word, English word Godhead appears three times. But the word translated Godhead here is not used the other two times. It's only used here. And literally it means the attributes of the divine nature. That's really what the word means. The attributes of divinity. That by looking at the things that are made, you can clearly see the attributes of divinity. You know, you look at creation. And you see that, among other things, God made animals. And among animals, God made you. Fine. That's nice. But he made animals and he made you in such a way that you get hungry. You know, every about 2 or 3 times a day, you like some food. So God made food. That shows you something about God. It shows you he's just. That he won't make that which is dependent without making that also upon which it is dependent for it to have. So you see justice in that. But justice does not say that food has got to be delicious. Justice only says that food has got to be nutritious. Love says it's going to be delicious. It's God's love that puts the flavor. It's the justice that puts in the energy and the strength. He gave you a nose. And the sense of smell. Justice says you have to have odors. But love says they can be the odors of a flower, not just the odors of the skunk. The fact that there are odors that are pleasant is an attribute of love. And you can see this in other attributes of God by the things that are made. Perhaps many of you have seen this audiovisual program of Brother George Tate. I don't know if he showed it here last year or not. Comes out with this one line always. The refrain to the program is, the things we see, thank you, Sandy. I couldn't bring it to mind. All that I have seen teaches me to trust the Creator for all that I have not seen. That's the point. That's seeing the invisible. It is using the mind to deduce from the visible the attributes of the invisible. Now, we've looked at this so far in the aspect of appreciating the love, generosity, the beauty of God. But where we need to see the invisible more than that is in the trials of life, in the hardships. And somehow, even in a hardship, you can't just go out and look at a tree and say, oh, that tree knows, makes me know I'm going to come out of this hardship. And maybe some of you can, I can't. No, I look at the tree and I might just envy the tree and say, boy, you haven't got any troubles. No, I sound like David when he was fleeing from Absalom. He said, I wish I was like a dove and could fly away from this whole thing. It doesn't really, but what does do it is there are things that you can see that he has made. And that's your past. You can go back. You can see in the past experiences those places where he has stepped in. And by seeing his operation in the past, you can see how he operates in the present and in the future. All that I have seen. Sandy, finish it again. Teaches me to trust the Creator for all that I have not seen. All that we've seen in our past lives. All these little places where we didn't even at the time know he was there. But we've taken the time now to go back and to look. You know, again, I think about the book of Esther. Remember the night that Ahasuerus couldn't sleep? I don't blame him. He was probably thinking in his mind, what's Esther got up her sleeve? She won't tell me. So she has this big dinner, and I asked her what she wants. She says, come tomorrow. She said, I guess I wouldn't sleep that night either. So I think there's got to be something behind that woman. So he did what I do when I can't sleep. He got out the most boring thing he'd find, book of history, and said, read me the history. And so he started reading the history of the past experiences. And there he saw the invisible. He saw how a man saved his life. And all of a sudden he said, you know, what did I ever do for that person? Nothing. And that was part of the invisible hand of God. He saw even in his pagan life the hand of the invisible. We need to go back at times and read the chronicles of our past history. There's some beautiful books. I really like to someday read more depthly the book of Nicora. I'm sure there's some interesting episodes in that book, and the book of De Groot, and the book of Zielinski, and all these little books that we have that are in our mind. There's fascinating little episodes. As we go back and see these little episodes, we see the invisible. And seeing that the invisible was working there, we know that the invisible will work here. You know, when I was doing the notes on this, I didn't even realize I had a theme. And all of a sudden, the theme has appeared to me, and I still can't repeat the theme. One more time, Sandy. Loudly, so we can all get it this time. Maybe I can remember it. Now, I'm going to try that. All that I have seen teaches me to trust the Creator for all that I have not seen. Maybe I learned it that time. Thank you. Okay, we need to have this reflection, this going back and tracing the invisible in our life. It's important. Because when we can avoid discouragement. We don't need to be down. By seeing the invisible, Romans 8:28 becomes more than just another scripture. Romans 8:28 then becomes a living verity. Come on. I can't quote Romans 8:28. Somebody help me on this one. All things, we know, all things work together. No, for good. For those who love God and have the call according to His purpose. I'm glad I got an audience that helps the poor speaker out. Okay. We know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to His purpose. This is where you've got that treasury. This is where we are so thankful that by the eyes of faith, we're not limited to trees and birds and brethren. But we can see the invisible, His hand in our individual affairs, the workings of providence.
Thank you, Brother Carl.